Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Erica Spindler, whose new thriller is Justice for Sarah, and poet Jack Bedell, whose new book is Bone Hollow True, New and Selected Poems. And we'll have an audio postcard from Kate Richardson, who had a blast at the Ernest Hemingway celebration, Pobre de Mi. Erica Spindler is a New York Times and internationally best-selling author. She's the nicest person you'd ever meet, so it's a little surprising that she turns out thrillers the way Café Du Monde turns out beignets, dependably and deliciously. She's the author of 31 books, the most recent of which is Justice for Sarah, which is just out. Welcome to The Reading Life, Erica.
Thanks for having me on, Susan.
Now, Justice for Sarah is one of those page-turners that takes its impetus from small-town history. So tell us about that.
Well, I do love small towns, and the town in Justice for Sarah is actually based on Madisonville. I had to change the names in the town to protect the innocent, but a small town is its own little microcosm of society, and everybody knows everybody, and they know their secrets, and they don't have a lot to talk about, so they talk about each other. I think it's a fascinating setting for a story, especially one like this one that revolves around a cold case, an unsolved murder, although the town thinks they have it solved. But
right. And Kat McCall, your protagonist in this book, comes back to Liberty, Louisiana to clear her name. So what are some of the things she's up against in this book?
Oh, wow.
A lot.
A lot. She's up against pretty much everything and everyone. You know, I've got the saying, put your big girl pants on. You know, it's something you have to do. And she just really, she has to like muster everything she's got to come back to this town where everyone accused her. I mean, she's lost everyone, basically. Her sister's found brutally murdered, and she doesn't even has to face herself and her own guilt because although she's acquitted of the crime, you know, a big part of her feels guilty because of her actions. Like maybe something she did actually did contribute to the murder of her sister. So she has no allies and she's just got her, you know, determination.
And this is a book that has some really horrific acts of violence. How hard was that for you to write, really?
Well, not that hard.
Uh-oh.
Shouldn't say that. You know, I don't think of my books as particularly violent. And I say that only because most of the time you see the act of violence after the fact.
Right.
You don't see the act of violence, you know, happening. So in a way it's off stage. So you experience as the reader, you know, the aftermath, which is pretty horrifying.
Right. The memory of violence.
The memory of violence. I'm really interested in the ramifications of violence and the emotional consequences of violence more than the violence itself.
Now, Jim Burke always says that to write books like this, you have to dwell in some very dark places. Do you feel that?
Yeah, I do. I do. And a few years ago, I mean, people were always saying, you know, how do you come up with these ideas? And several years ago, I realized that I have what I call the dark gift. And the dark gift is this natural inclination to take anything to the most tragic or darkest place. For example, the first time I really wondered why I think the way I think, my husband and I were young newlyweds in our first home in mid-city New Orleans. And I remember in the worst heat of summer, probably August, I remember standing there and he was on a ladder and he was nailing a board like above his head, a big 2x4. So he's kind of like nailing upside down and I'm just standing below him with, you know, the next nail at the ready. And as I'm watching him, he's sweating and it's hot and that board is big. And in my mind's eye, I very clearly see him losing his grip on the board and it hits him in the head. I see the blood flying. I hear my scream, you know, and I was like, what is wrong with you, Erica? You know, why do you think these things? But I just do. And, you know, I think that I process that, and that's where my stories all come from. They all come from something I've seen or experienced or felt and just kind of spiraled it out to that worst possible case scenario.
Wow.
But that doesn't mean I'm not a negative
I know,
person
you're
or
you're
dark.
Smiling as you
smiling
say
as I'm saying it. But it's funny because at signing events and speaking events, and I talk about the dark gift, there's always a couple people after who come like scurrying up to me and they're like, I've got it too. And now I see what it is, you know.
Now, Erica, you're one of those rare writers who's made the great transition from writing romance novels to writing standalone thrillers like this. Mm-hmm. What kind of process has that been for you? And do you see any writing frontiers ahead of you that you want to explore still?
It's been a really incredible journey, and one that I like to think of it as following my muse. And perhaps in a business sense, that wouldn't have been the best way to do it, because if you know publishing, you do one book, they want another one almost just like it. And I went through this process from romance to kind of a big Cinderella story to, you know, a family drama set in New Orleans, you know, with a little bit of suspense, which just caught me. And I just loved writing the suspense and the crime part. And so I built on that. So, you know, I never have really settled in. I guess I have now, but it was like this long process where I just followed my muse, doing a little bit different book each time. And I feel like with Justice for Sarah, I'm kind of turning back. I took my books all the way through a few that very little relationship, no romance, very much crime scene investigation and, you know, cops and robbers, basically. And now I've kind of circled back and I'm pulling more relationships back into the book, be they romance or otherwise. It's almost like I've kind of come full circle in that way. Frontiers, I still, you know, would like to write a real series. You know, I have some New Orleans crossover characters, you know, the Malone family, and I love writing them, but it's not really a series. So I've thought about that. I've thought about trying my hand at a little bit of more fantasy.
So are you feeling the pressure to turn out a book a year?
There is a lot of pressure to turn out. It's been 2 years since I've had a book out. I'm one of those people that's just pretty upfront about things. And I came up with a story idea that my publisher just didn't like. It was just a little too far out there. It was set in New Orleans in the transgender community. And, you know,
it's ripe for fiction.
Ripe for fiction. I mean, exactly. I just love the whole New Orleans atmosphere. And I just thought that my readers wouldn't, yeah. So anyway, I had written 150 pages of it, so I had to put it aside and do something else. So, you know, I lost time in that. Luckily, I have all those words, and I'm integrating them into other things.
Well, now people will wait for that.
Wait for that.
Now, I have to ask you, you know, a lot of your books come out in the summer. This is a perfect summer read, Justice for Sarah.
Thank you.
You take it to the beach. Spend this, you know, long day in the company of these fascinating characters. So what kinds of things do you read in the summertime?
Currently, I am on just a terrible deadline. I'm a little behind on my book and between promoting and writing. So I'm reading a lot of things this summer that are not fiction. Like right now, I'm reading the book An Altar in the World, which is really about finding the sacred in the everyday, you know, and it's really just kind of lyrical and because I don't want to be influenced by other writers, you know, because I'm writing every day. I just really want to be taken away from what I do.
That's a beautiful book. I've read that book.
Have you?
Yeah.
Isn't it beautiful? Mm-hmm. I just love it so far. But a lot of times I'd read a Janet Ivanovich. Her Stephanie Plum books just crack me up. So they're very different. My books tend to be a little bit on the darker side, more emotional. Hers are more fun. So I feel like I'm safe there, you know. I'll read someone like Alisa Scott-Aline. I have, you know, a number of author friends who have books coming out, so I'm going to be reading those as well.
I know. That's a duty when
it
you
is.
Get to this point. Now, you're in touch with your readers through your website, ericaspindler.com.
Yes.
So what kinds of things do you hear from them?
I'm very active on Facebook as well. Not as much on Twitter, but more on Facebook. I actually have some private groups of really devoted fans. We have the Secret Spindler Society, and I have the Spindler Street Sirens. So, you know, they're the ones that get like firsthand, first pictures, you know, posting pictures and stories and all sorts of stuff. We do some fun things. But what am I hearing from fans? When are you going to get another book out? Can't wait for your next book. which is great. That is really nice. Other people, you know, I really want to see Kit and MC again. When are you going to do Kit and MC again? You know, things like that. Where do I find books? I mean, there's a lot of confusion now with writers even. Like, where do they find books? There's still, you know, people who don't do electronic books.
And thank goodness.
I mean, there's someone. I, say that. I know that the hardcover's so pretty. I posted this morning. This is going to sound tacky. I just got my first hardcover. They sent me one yesterday evening. So I posted to my special fans that it was so beautiful, I wanted to sleep with it. And then I'm like, wow, that sounds really nasty. But it was just so pretty. It's just, you know, and you just don't get that from an electronic book.
Well, the thrill of opening your book, it never gets old, does it?
No, it doesn't.
You know?
It does.
Even after 31.
Even after 31 books.
Impressive. Well, we've been talking with Erica Spindler, whose new book is Justice for Sarah. And for more information, check out ericaspindler.com. Thank you so much, Erica.
Thank you, Susan. This was so fun.
It's too darn hot. It's too darn hot. I'd like to sup with.
New Orleanians bring a lot of style to their love of books. Think of the literary floats and Mardi Gras parades, literary landmarks like Tennessee Williams House and Faulkner House Books. And then there are all those folks who stand in Jackson Square and scream for Stella at the Tennessee Williams Festival. But Hemingway fans have their swagger too, and every summer now brings San Fermin de Nueva Orleans, with a Running of the Bulls Pamplona style with Big Easy Roller Girls, and the Pobre de Mi celebration with Hemingway skits and impersonators. Kate Richardson was there to bring us this audio postcard.
Ernest Hemingway and New Orleans have many things in common. Heavy drinking, a strong connection to French and Spanish culture. This year's Pobre de Mi was a prime example of that spiritual kinship. The afternoon began at the Bar Maison with a loosely regulated skit contest. Performances ranged from Hemingway's slow jams.
I am no romantic glorifier of the Spanish woman, nor did I ever think of a casual peace as anything more than a casual peace in any country. But when I am with Maria, oh, I love her so.
To a dramatization of the infamous Hemingway-Fitzgerald manhood exam described in the memoir, A Movable Feast.
Zelda said that the way I was built, I could never make any woman happy.
Some skits got delightfully tangential. Local writer and ukulelist John Polt celebrated this year's theme with a nod to Hemingway's famous literary mentor in Paris.
In Paris, Paris, Paris. Gertrude Stein LGBT. Paris, Paris. Les maisons de ukulele.
Then, time for the lookalike contest. I wanted to know how the contenders prepared mentally and physically to embody the true Papa spirit. Did they, like Hemingway, tend to a herd of six-toed cats?
No, but I will tell you this. I made a finger that I actually glued to my hand to where I have six fingers. That's a true story, too.
That's two-time Hemingway lookalike contest champion Pat Lanier on his strategy for success. He competed yet again at this year's event, explaining what, besides his prosthetic sixth finger, made him the most worthy candidate.
Me and Hemingway both wrote the true sentence, and my sentence is, the hula hoop woman, the burlesque woman, and all these pink ladies can eat crackers in my bed.
Six Hemingway hopefuls danced up to the stage, escorted by the Pussyfooters Marching Club in full pink regalia. One by one, they declared themselves the drunkest, manliest, most impressively bearded Hemingway in the room.
I drank Hemingway under the table.
I love beer. I love women. I love life.
Okay, I think I should win because I have a confession to make. Not really Ernest Hemingway. I'm his second wife, Pauline.
But in the end, it was second-time competitor John Chepleski of Destin, Florida, who is crowned King of the Papas. Why did he deserve the title? Well, in the words of the champion himself,
Por qué no?
Why not? And how does it feel to be named first place Hemingway lookalike?
Well, it was exhilarating. I didn't think I had much of a chance because I was sizing up the competition, and there were some former winners there, and any time you're going up against a champion, you don't know. And last year I didn't make the cut, but my beard wasn't quite long enough.
The newly crowned king and his bearded minions led a second-line parade around the bar as the crowd dispersed into the afternoon sun. To quote Hemingway in the last chapter of The Sun Also Rises, the fiesta was finished. For The Reading Life, I'm Kate Richardson.
Poet Jack Bedell is an English professor at Southeastern Louisiana University, where he also edits the journal Louisiana Literature and directs the Louisiana Literature Press. He's with us today to talk about his new book, Bone Hollow True, New and Selected Poems. Welcome to The Reading Life, Jack.
Hi, Susan. Glad to be here.
So a poet puts together a new and selected poems when they've gotten to a particular stage, when they've accumulated a body of work. So tell us about reviewing your work to put this together.
Well, you know, it sounded like a great idea when the press pitched it to me that it was time to do one, a new and selected. And I kind of jumped into it and started looking at the poems and fixing some of the inconsistencies and little problems that I found here and there. And I got about halfway in and was really miserable. It was like trying to Photoshop a box of 20 years worth of photos and make yourself look really good in all of them. And I was shocked at how I barely knew the guy who made those decisions I was fixing, and I thought it was wrong. And I wound up putting everything back the way it was and just letting it ride and saying, this is the arc of the 20 years that I've been doing this, and I hope people can see some of the development, my own growth as a person. It's really a matter of letting it go, like Anne Bradstreet said in one of her poems, of letting the children out into the world, because there's nothing I could do to fix some of those decisions that wouldn't really be a lie in the revision. It wasn't the pleasant experience, but I think it was a growth experience for me.
Oh, wow. Well, it's hard work always to look back. Tell me, how did you know it was even possible to be a poet when you were growing up? When did you decide to become a writer?
I fell into it kind of honestly. I think that I've always been a storyteller. One of my relatives wrote the history of the Bedell family, and I was listed as one of the top three liars in family history. And that was as a small child. And I've always loved listening to stories and telling stories. And part of the joy of that is layering in just enough untruth to make it interesting. And when I was shown by a teacher of mine a book by R.S. Gwynn, Sam Gwynn, a poet from Lamar, called The Drive-In, a book of poems about barbecue and going to movies. And I realized that poetry didn't have to be William Blake, or it didn't have to be some English romantic ideal, and it didn't have to be about philosophy, and that it could just be stories about growing up in South Louisiana and kind of tributes to the people that you love and who have shaped you. Then I started writing poems. And it's not that it came easily to me, but it's always been driven by that kind of honesty in the storytelling and in the urge to kind of keep a record of what's made me the person I am. And there's a real joy in the challenge of trying to tell a story in 24, 30 lines in a way that I've not had that same joy in writing prose. There's the confines of poetry and the rhythmic potential and the ability to be as concise as possible that just really challenges me. And it's an uphill climb, and I love that.
It's such a discipline. It's a spiritual discipline, I think, sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a respect for language that drives me, and respect for tradition. And that's never going to become easy. And that's another great thing for me, is the notion that it'll be challenging until I just can't do it anymore. When I can't pick my hands up to the keyboard, it's going to be a challenge right up to that moment. And it's never something I can coast doing. And that keeps me going.
So some of the most remarkable poems in this book come from a project you undertook with Daryl Bork, Call and Response. And I've seen you both read these poems in concert, in a way, and that strikes me as one of the most remarkable literary interchanges in Louisiana history.
You know, Daryl Bork, as you know, one of the greatest human beings that we have, is
he
a
really
treasure
is.
Of Louisiana. I've known him since I was a teenager, and before he was a teacher of mine, he was a friend and a role model, and everything about the way he lives his life is really the person I'd like to grow up to be one day. And working with him was a true joy. But beyond all that, it was a point in my life when I was ill. I had contracted West Nile and it had kind of jumped on my central nervous system, and it was causing all kind of lethargy issues and paralysis and nervous tics and just a lot of depression. And I hadn't done anything in a year, and I just kind of reached out to Daryl and begged him to send me a poem and that I would promise to try to send him one back. And the first time he sent me a poem, he sent me two or three poems, actually. It took me about a month to get something in response. And we didn't know what we were doing, but we knew that as long as he would send me new work, I would send him something in response that was in some way related. And as the project kind of evolved, it turned into a situation where he and I were sending poems to each other on the same subjects simultaneously. And when we finished the book, we wrote poems about the cover image. And those poems were sent within seconds of each other. And that's when we knew we had done the book, that we had done what we had come to do. And we'd kind of gotten to the same wavelength and had finally kind of been successful in awakening the exchange of the voice and the productivity and everything I set out to do. And, you know, I can't thank him enough for the effort and the faith he showed in me to keep that going for a year, because I couldn't have done it without him. And I couldn't have done anything. I could barely put my socks on when we started. And by the end of it, I felt as close to normal as I felt in years.
And you're back.
Thanks to Daryl.
And we're all glad. We're all glad you're back. Now, so many of these poems deal with your family life. How did they feel about being the muses for your work?
I think it's a growth process for everybody involved. Beth, my wife, and my kids, they're tickled that they remember these moments. And I think the fact that I value these moments that are really pretty simple and mundane to them is a real joy. I think it wakes up in particularly my children the understanding of what it is we should be appreciating in our lives, that it's not the big moment when you win the lottery. It's the moment when the sun hits the right spot over the trees and there's a fish on the line. That's the moment when we ought to be making something for posterity, or we need to celebrate these triumphs that happen 20, 30 times a day. And the kids are learning that. They're picking up on it. They haven't started calling out the poems yet as they happen. But that's going to be a real benefit when my sons and daughter start saying, "That's one, Dad. Hey, write this one down, Dad."
Now, so many of your poems draw on Louisiana life and culture. The Cajun Mardi Gras, for example. There's one in particular that I just love called "The Vegetarian Warms Up to the Dance Floor." I wonder if you'd tell us about that poem.
Tim Gotro and I used to go, back when life was a little simpler, when there were fewer kids in my household, we'd go to Mamou on Saturdays and to go dancing and go listen to some music. And it was before my marriage, and I was kind of doing some dating experiments. And I think at the kind of nadir of all that, I was dating this wonderful girl who happened to be a vegetarian, which is about as far from my gene pool as you could ever get. I mean, I'm a long history of all-you-can-eaters. And we brought her to Mamou, and while they were passing out boudin and beer and trying to get her to loosen up, all that stuff in that poem happened, and Tim was the chief orchestrator of it. And it was my blessing to be a witness to it all and to watch him try to unravel this girl and see how she could loosen up and enjoy life a little bit. No disrespect to vegetarians at all. It's just that it was a meat eater's world we were in, and I realized I was a meat eater and on the wrong path.
And Tansu was passing out her boudin from the cardboard box, right?
Exactly, and free schnapps. And so it takes a special kind of person that can grin and bear schnapps and boudin at 8 in the morning.
I love the way you say that T. Gotro swept her into the boil of dancers, because that's really what that is.
If you've never seen Tim Gotro dance, you're missing out. Tim creates a stir anytime we go any place with him, because the women line up once they see how he can move. They, you know, a man dancer or a male dancer that wants to dance, it becomes like a carnival ride. And for him to grab her and pull her into those dancers, when there was a long line for Tim's services, it was a nice morning.
So you seem to feel very strongly a part of a literary community of writers.
Well, I've had some great mentors for sure. And I've had people who have been really gracious with their time and kind of their patience with me for sure, whether it's, you know, Tim or Daryl Bourque or people like Virgil Suarez, a Cuban-American writer, Norman German, who was one of my first teachers. Those people have really taken more than their share of time with me, and a lot of what I do is paying back their effort and their patience.
Well, you pay it forward with your students and with the journal and all those enterprises.
And that's definitely a labor. All that's a labor of love, and that's no effort on my part. That's just a real privilege to help other writers on their journey, and particularly with my students. the ability to see their energy on a day-to-day basis and their creativity and the courage that they have to try the things that they try, it keeps me going more than anything else. I mean, I wish I had some of the courage to try different styles or voices or techniques that these students have, particularly the poets that I teach on a day-to-day basis at Southeastern. It's inspiring, and it's really humbling to see the effort they're making and the faith they have in my own advice for them. It certainly makes me more open as a writer and willing to take chances and get my stuff out there.
And what are you going to read for us today? You're going to read us a new poem, aren't you?
Well, it's one of the first poems that I wrote from the new section. It's actually the first poem in the new book. It's called First Come the Perch. As soon as the biscuits my daughter throws from the dock hit the pond, the perch's sides flash gold burst just under the surface, stealing bites and flurries without ever touching air. The water boils with them for a while, then glasses over, still. It's not until she dumps the whole pail of bread into the water that the mallards push from the reeds and catfish swell up from the silt to gulp down her offerings. Red-eared turtles drop off logs to join the frenzy. Even the eyes of a yearling gator float close. My daughter leans farther and farther off the dock to take it all in, just laughing, pointing, breathing in the sunset touching the tops of the trees around us. My father and I take turns holding the back of her dress as she bends over the water, him watching the dangers at hand, me tracking the movement of air bubbles inching toward us from the deepest end of the pond.
That's so lovely. And isn't that the work of the poet, to always look for what's at the deepest end of the pond?
Without the foreboding and all the dangers. You know, I would love to have seen the happiness. That's probably me as the worrying dad, that's for sure. I'm the dad that puts as many pads on the kids and helmets. And if I could shrink wrap and bubble wrap, I'd shrink wrap them all.
Well, let's hope your dad doesn't think that's inaccurate. I love that poem. We've been talking with Jack Bedell, whose new book is Bone Hollow True, New and Selected Poems. Thank you so much, Jack.
Thanks, Susan. It was my pleasure to be here.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses In the Sanctuary of Outcasts by Neil White, Tuesday, August 6th at 5:45 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Poet Nancy Harris reads from Beauty Eating Beauty, and poet Melinda Palacio reads from How Fire is a Story Waiting, Tuesday, August 6th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Michelle Antoine Goisha Nicholas, founder of the Louisiana Basque American Society and Cultural Organization, discusses local Basque culture and history at 7 p.m. Tuesday, August 6th at East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Cherise Nelson signs The Year of the Spy Boy, Wednesday, August 7th from 6 to 8 at Community Book Center. The Fiat Lux Book Club discusses The Power and the Glory by Graham Greene, Wednesday, August 7th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple. This group discusses the influence of the Catholic faith on writers from Graham Greene to Walker Percy. Tony Kaiser and Lindsay Barnes of the National World War II Museum discuss their new book, Loyal Forces, The American Animals of World War II, 7 p.m. Thursday, August 8th at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. And George Bishop signs Night of the Comet, Tuesday, August 13th at 6 at Octavia Books. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening, and keep reading.